Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themacguffinman.com, if you want to catch up on our previous episodes. We most recently talked about Colossal, before that was War Machine, and before that was 3 Days of the Condor. I've also written a bunch of things recently, most recently about Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt and Enlightened, a show nobody watched, so that was a pretty fucking great idea on my part, and Master of None as well. So you can check those out, themacguffinman.com. You can follow us on Twitter, at the MacGuffin Man, and it seems like that's it. So let's hit the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Uh-huh.
As per usual, we have returned from the theme song unscathed.
Mm-hmm.
This will be the last time music is heard until the very end, just like the movie we're talking about here today.
Yes. Yeah. We're talking about 12 Angry Men.
Yes.
First question.
Great. Love it already.
I'm inquisitive off the bat. Is this the end of our movie connection train?
I think that's how the Colossal podcast starts, is you asking that question. Because what's the connection between War Machine and Colossal? Just that they star movie stars that we like, and they were movies that we kind of enjoyed?
I guess. All right, I won't ask that question.
I guess that we've started a new train by asking that question in two consecutive podcasts.
Or can we connect War Machine to this, or Colossal to this?
No. I could sit here and think, that wasn't one of the questions you posed to me in an email, so I haven't thought about it.
All right, I'll keep my eye out for next week.
Yeah, okay.
When we do 13 Angry Men, I'll be ready.
No, we'll do the William Friedkin TV movie adaptation, 12 Angry Men.
Okay, well, enough of that.
Great.
12 Angry Men, 1957.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised we hadn't done this movie earlier.
Yeah, it's a pretty great movie. We are both noted Sidney Lumet fans.
Yes, on this podcast.
Yeah, exactly. But yes, it's a fantastic film, widely regarded as such, and justifiably so.
Yeah, and I guess it didn't really, it was kind of a box office disappointment at the time, and then Henry Fonda, who produced this movie as well, chose to never produce anything again.
I shall produce no more forever.
Yeah, but it was critically well received, and got 3 nominations for the Oscar, didn't win any of them.
What were the nominations, do you know?
Picture, screenplay, and director, maybe?
Gotcha. I'll look that up.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And I was surprised to learn that it just got into the Library of Congress in 2007, because, I mean, sure, it may have had a slow start to be as appreciated as it is, but by 2007, it had been very widely lauded.
Yeah. You are right about the nominations. It was picture, screenplay, adapted screenplay, and director. Yeah, that does seem very late to me. That is a fact I was unaware of. I don't know when they started putting movies in the Library of Congress. I feel like every date I've heard for it is post-2000, but I also am certain that they must have started inducting these things before then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So why do you think it is? Like, how did it turn out as well as it did, I guess? I don't know. I look at it as, you know, as I meant to say, it's also a very high up there on the IMDb top 250.
Well.
And, well.
I just want to be on record as having qualms with that list. I don't have any qualms with 12 Angry Men being included, but that list is kind of a minefield. But continue.
Yes, I will agree with that. But even just compared to movies that you expect to be up here, it's a pretty short movie. It's not an epic, you know. It's a bottle episode essentially, mm-hmm. And not a ton of action. And it seems like a bit of an outlier, even though it's as good as it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and especially, like, at the time, the late 50s, early 60s, like, you're getting into a real transitional period in filmmaking as well. I would imagine in 1957, this didn't look like a lot of movies that were coming out in 1957, just because I think the way that it is shot is sort of more inventive than I think the average movie that would have been coming out in 1957. I can't say for certain because I wasn't going to the movies in 1957, but like that's sort of the feeling I get when I watch other movies in the 50s, that this was sort of on its way to being a movie that kind of looks more like something that would have been made in the late 60s, you know, despite the fact that the photography is black and white and the camera moves still are very 1950s camera moves, but just because of equipment limitations. But yeah, it does seem like to be a more creative movie visually, given how few options it would feel like it would have. And like you said, it was a bottle episode, which is a type of movie I always appreciate. I recently saw Beatrice at Dinner, which is the same thing. It was fantastic. It's just a style of movie that I love because it does sort of, I mean, it confines the filmmaker and the writer. It's like, this is the world that I've built for myself, and this world is like 16 by 34 or whatever, you know? Yeah. And I can only write so many situations into the screenplay, and I can only write so many camera moves as the director. Like, there's just very limited options, and I feel like you have the chance to get something dreadfully boring, but when it works, I think it works so well because the people in charge have to be so inventive to make it interesting, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, it's this movie's such a showcase. You know, we get, I guess, 13 speaking parts, 14 speaking parts, I guess, count the bailiff and the judge. And otherwise, you know, we just have 12 characters, and with so little action, I mean, it's pretty much endless dialogue. You get a chance to round out these characters, and if the writing's not there, the performance isn't there, as you said, the product can end up being kind of insufferable. But if you manage to do those things well, it functions as such a showcase for people who are good at their job on and off camera.
Yeah, exactly. And Sidney Lumet had a I mean, this is the first movie he directed, or first theatrical film he directed. He had a real reputation, certainly not at the time, this is the beginning of that reputation, as being an actor's director. He was huge on rehearsal. This movie I think kind of famously had a lot of rehearsal time, but he was very big on rehearsals all throughout his career, just because he found that was a way to save time on set. And that tends to be the common thinking about rehearsals, is that you can work through a lot of problems you would have on set before you actually get there, and then you can save the money just by having everybody in a room, like a boardroom or whatever, running through the script, you know. Yeah, and that's sort of one of the ways that I think this movie, one of the key aspects of Lumet that makes this movie as good as it is, good actors, director, and also just was able to put them all in a position to succeed, like sort of made them work together so much that apparently different sides of conversations in this movie are being shot like a week apart, you know, because of the lighting confines and the budget confines that they had to deal with. And just so that everybody sort of rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed to the point where they could just do this over and over again and have it feel natural. This is kind of something like how we talked about it with Glengarry Glen Ross, where they rehearsed in something that was marked out like the set, and just went over and over and over the screenplay, so that when they actually got on set and were ready to roll camera, they had worked out a lot of different problems, you know?
Yeah, you had mentioned that they spent a lot of time rehearsing, and I just think it's important to point out, it's not because they had a ton of time and money. It's, you know, this was a movie with a relatively low budget. As you said, his directorial debut, I mean, at least cinematically, for Sidney Lumet, and he had a small window when he to make it, and he chose to spend most of that rehearsing, and it wasn't, they rehearsed a lot out of luxury. It was, even within a very economical time frame, he thought that would be the thing that allows the actors to be the best at their job. And I thought that what you mentioned about them having to shoot these conversations, you know, a week or two apart, you know, do everybody's dialogue in, you know, one lighting section and move through that, it seems so counterintuitive. But when you have these performers who are talented, and as you said, have put them in a position to succeed, it still comes off as such an organic performance.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that still happens. We talked about Out of Sight a few weeks ago, and there's a scene where Jennifer Lopez is talking to Viola Davis in the doorway of Viola Davis's home, and the house part was shot, or the J-Lo shots were done in Detroit, and then the Viola Davis shots were done in California weeks later, you know, and that scene's still seamless. Like, that's something that happens when you just have to combine locations still. But yeah, it's still very impressive, you know, especially in a movie like this where the emotion of each character gets ratcheted up so slowly and precisely that it's amazing that you can't tell that, you know, when watching the movie, you know?
Yeah, it is very progressive in that way, more than I think other movies are, as far as ramping up and escalating. And
that's just a lot to keep track of for the actors. It's a lot to keep track of for the director. It's like, where are we on the scale of 1 to 10 of like big performance right now, you know?
Yeah, and from the technical standpoint, I mean, you can talk more about the angles and the lenses being used because that's more your expertise, but that's just one other thing that needs to be considered when not shooting it scene by scene, but shooting it setup by setup. So I don't know if that's a good opportunity for you to shed some light on that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it seems to be one of the things that everybody, or when I say everybody, I mean everybody in this very small community of film obsessives that you and I belong to. They all know technically about the film, but like it's because Sidney Lumet in his book Making Movies, which I have talked about on this podcast before because it is a fantastic book. He runs through all of his movies and sort of explains the idea behind the cinematography in it. And for 12 Angry Men, what he wanted to do was sort of start with very wide angle lenses and sort of get to a point where so you're starting on, say, like a 28 millimeter lens, which has a lot of depth of field, keeps a lot of things in focus. And as the movie progresses, the lenses get longer and longer, which compresses the background, gives you more shallow depth of field, and makes the characters feel like more alone in the frame, whatever's in focus of the frame, at least. And then at the end of the movie, he widens out. And apparently the last shot of the movie is the widest lens they use in the whole movie, because these guys are now going back out into the world. And also just the way that the camera uses perspective, in that we start with high angles. I mean, it's most obvious in the title card scene, the opening credits, where you're just in this high angle wide shot of all of these characters coming into the room at one time, and it's this long take, and you get a cut when we go to Henry Fonda by himself at the window, you know, just showing the separation of the one from the other 11, which is a fantastic cut, but sort of it also puts a nice button on that long take. But it's a high angle shot,
and yeah, like then, a bird's eye view.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then throughout the movie, and it is very subtle, like you really have to look for it to notice it. But by the end of the movie, the camera's moving lower and lower and lower, to the point where, you know, you can see top parts of walls now, you can get the feeling that the ceiling is present. So that the idea, according to Lumet, was to make it feel like this room is closing in on people. And it also sort of shows some shifting in power of the characters as well. Like, there's a couple really odd looking close-ups of the oldest juror, early in the movie, where he's looking directly into camera, but he's kind of framed from a high angle. And then later on, as he's sort of describing the glasses, which is kind of the last point that swings the remaining jurors, he's framed in a really low angle because now he's in a position of power because he's explaining to these people his glasses theory. Yeah,
and even...
And that happens all throughout the movie.
Yeah, and even for everybody, not necessarily the idea of them dominating people, but even attempting to dominate people, or just emotions getting so big that, you know, in a very animalistic way, just puffing yourself up, you know, mm-hmm. making yourself look bigger, making yourself look more dominant and more threatening as emotions ramp up. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the lower angle seems to always dominate the viewer, whereas a higher one kind of dominates the subject. And as these... as the people in the room get more and more intense, and some people dig their heels further and further into their positions, the lower angle, I think, works for that as well.
Yeah, for sure. And another thing that I love about how this movie is shot is that the way that it shows Fonda framed, a lot of times you'll get, especially towards the beginning, he'll be having a conversation with you know, somebody else, and then you cut to whoever he's talking to, and there are two jurors beside, like in the frame beside the person that's talking. You know, there's just more people in the space. And then you cut back to Fonda, and he is framed alone because he is the man that is alone at the beginning of the movie. You know, and throughout the movie, you get a better point, or again, something like the old man explaining the glasses becoming in a position of power. So the angle of the camera switches on him, and you start to see more people, especially towards the very end, in the frame of Fonda. I think the most notable moment from this is when. The angry juror Lee Cobb, I forget his number, he's when he becomes alone after Fonda's done this big explanation. Maybe it's after the walking sequence, I can't remember, but you get Fonda in the middle of the frame surrounded by basically everybody else, and then on the other side of the room totally alone is Lee Cobb, and they cut to a close-up of Cobb, he's by himself, and then you cut back to Fonda and he's got other people in the frame for maybe the first time in the movie, you know.
Yeah, and he's so deep in the frame, and they're all facing each other, but we're mostly seeing the front of that juror in the backs of everybody else. People haven't turned their back to him the way that literally happens at other points in this movie, but it just, there's this total sense of negation. Like, it's just everybody else's back in your face, and it's just this juxtaposition of all these people feeling one way, and then this other guy deep in the frame, and we see his face where we see everybody else's back.
Yeah, exactly. And he also, in that wide shot, he looks so physically small.
Yeah, and he's leaning up against the wall as though he needs support. Like, he's kind of wilting under the pressure of everybody else. So that is when they're talking about the old man walking to the door and doing the talking, and he's kind of figuratively and literally taken aback by everybody forming up against him, you know?
Yeah, it's a fantastic shot. I felt like that was the part, but it also seems like slightly too early in the movie for it to happen, you know? Just because not everybody's on Fonda's side at that point, right?
Yeah, no, it is, but it's in my notes, my comprehensive notes.
Well, thank you for being so comprehensive where I failed to.
Yeah, and one thing I don't want to necessarily lose in what we were talking about of all those shots being done separately is the tremendously difficult blocking and choreography that happens in some of the longer takes of this, and people you know, exiting the frame, or people showing up in the background, all extremely intentionally.
Yeah, absolutely, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Especially, and the best example is that sort of bird's eye view shot very early on, where all the characters are coming into the juror room, just because, you know, I watched this movie and only towards, or I watched this movie about a week ago. I had seen it a couple times before, but like only towards the end of the shot, I was like, well, there hasn't been a cut in a long time. And you know, it's so seamless that you don't even sort of realize that it's a long take, because the camera does move throughout it, but it's, you know, it's a move that's relatively simple, and then a hold for a bit, and then a move that's relatively simple, and then a hold for a bit. And part of that is limitations of the time period and the technology of the 1950s. But it also sort of just keeps you engrossed by never cutting, but also keeps you engrossed by keeping the camera movement relatively simple.
Yeah, and it feels like five different setups, because it is, but it's also one take.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the Spielberg one-er, where he does all of these all these setups within one shot, and you don't realize that it's one shot. You know, he just sort of, he adds the edit into the shot, but somehow also erases the edit. You know, like, I don't know. I feel like that doesn't make sense, but you understand what I mean.
Yeah, and a moment that we just touched on too, but I think shares this, is when he's mapping out that old man's walk from the bed, and you know, measures it off and walks around the room to pace it off, and then kind of performs it for everybody. And that's a moment, as we said earlier, that's a moment where things have changed. You know, we not everybody's necessarily formed up to 11 and 1, but things are certainly happening, and people are changing their mind more quickly. And the way he paces it off, and the way people follow him around, and the way people are yelling, it just, There's people, way more people stand up than we've ever seen standing up at the same time, other than entering the room for the first time. Mm-hmm. And it's just, there's more kinetic energy and just things are escalating in a way. And it's just one other sense, this one extremely physical, more so than just perspective, where things are elevating and things keep getting bigger and bigger or faster and faster.
Mm-hmm.
More people getting involved.
Yeah. It's like another great scene. Yeah.
Another great scene in this one scene.
Yeah, no, but I mean, you know when the scenes stop and start in this movie, you still kind of get a feeling, even though they don't really, other than a brief exit into the bathroom, they don't really change the location.
Yeah, that's true. And our book ends outside the room.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you want to talk about that, or at least maybe the beginning one? Or?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the beginning of this movie's fantastic because, you know, if you're watching 12 Angry Men now, chances are you know you're getting 12 Angry Men in a room. It's just 12 people in a room for the majority of the movie. And I think the first time I saw this movie was in high school, but I hadn't watched it again. And I probably watched it again in high school, but hadn't seen it since. So I just remembered it as all of these people in this one room. And the opening shots are amazing. Like the opening shot is very simple. It's just a simple pan up on the courthouse. You know, it's just from a very wide angle lens, low perspective on the building. It makes it seem like an imposing building. Like the things that happen here are important. So it just sets the tone there. And then you get this cut into, you know, the camera's on the upper level, but we're seeing people on the lower level just walking around going about their day, right? And then the focus changes to the second level as somebody walks by the camera, and he turns out he's going to the elevator to wait. He's very calmly looking for where he's going to go, and then out of the elevator comes a very sweaty man who looks very, very anxious about whatever's going on in his life. And then we follow him, the camera moves, and we follow him again without a cut. Past the phone booth where somebody's making a phone call and then gets out to go join his family for a brief celebration. Then they get shushed by the guard of the courtroom that's right next to them. And then we go inside that courtroom, which is where our part of the story takes place. And I just think that is an amazing setup, basically wordless, you know, like there's no real script that matters. Words are said, especially between that family. But
yeah,
all that matters is that you can see their emotion. And I think that's an amazing way to show that we're about to see people deciding how one person will get to live the rest of their life or not live it. But all of these different lives are happening in the same space. You know, just like there is another world outside of this room. And the idea is that you're not just fighting over this one person. You're fighting over like every person's sort of right to live and to live their own experience, you know?
Yeah, on the main floor where it starts, we have people moving in all different directions. And, you know, they're so far the distance, you can't really make out their faces, but they're all, as you said, moving about their day. And then we have someone totally bisect the byline, you know, walk completely across frame, and we get a good look at his face. And you kind of just assume, okay, that's establishing it's a courthouse that people are in, but this is our guy. And then you kind of follow him to the elevator, and that's it. And then we get on to a new guy. And the one thing I really love that wasn't mentioned there is that that guy who's sharing the good news in the elevator, in the phone booth, you know, you see he's really happy. He hangs up. And then that sad guy, the anxious guy you said, seemingly becomes the center of the center of the frame again. And as far as we know, the center of the story now, you know, maybe this is the guy whose story we're about to watch for the next 96 minutes and maybe 95. And then it's such a small thing, but I love it so much, is that that happy guy that we saw from the phone booth who seemed to be sharing good news becomes the center of the frame again. And now we're focusing on him speaking with his family. You know, that sad person is sort of outpaced by someone who clearly just experienced some kind of good news, some sort of relief. And then as we get to the picture of the courtroom, we see the bailiff or guard telling that family to quiet down again. You know, it's, this is great news, but there's another story happening in here. And this might be what you see as the best day of your life, but we have something so different happening somewhere nearby. And yeah, it's a good depiction of, you know, everybody is the main character of their own story kind of thing. But we're also about to watch a movie about how so many people's different their upbringing or their race or their class or their relationship with certain members of their family is totally changing who they are. So even though these 12 people are about to all experience the same story, they come from such different places and have such different perspective on this shared space. And for all that to be done, as you said, that quickly and without any words relating to the plot and without learning anybody's name or any memorable dialogue or voiceover, I think is so wonderful. And you can't really appreciate it the first time around. But then I just rewatched that just once more time just before starting this, even though I kind of felt like I knew what I was going to say about it. But it just seems that intricate and thematically on point.
Yeah, absolutely. And also just difficult to pull off.
Yeah, and it's another one of those just blocking things, right? It's just the timing of everybody working out well.
Mm-hmm.
And what about inside their courtroom?
Just sort of the way that the characters are introduced with the dolly shot across the jurors?
Yeah, I mean, we never see any of them alone.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I mean, they are shown as a group. I really enjoy the consistency of Henry Fonda's performance between the very wide shot and the dolly shot. Like, I don't know, just the way that he probably had to hold that pose for like so long. I've enjoyed that. But no, I suppose I don't have any thoughts on it. Yeah. And just that the way that other than, you know, when we cut to the accused, it's just a close up and he is the only person in frame. You know, like you get this a shot of this group that gets to decide the fate of this one, you know.
Yeah. And to compare what you said is that establishing shot of the courthouse looking very menacing and important, which it is. We have this performance by the judge is very bored and very perfunctory and like the lawyer that we never really see, seemingly someone who isn't that passionate about what they do, or at least not in this particular case, that this is just a job for some people. And although this kid's life is about to be decided, whether he gets to continue living it or not, with absolutely no wiggle room, apparently, it's still just kind of the grind for some people.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Not for these jurors, but... And that's what makes it so exceptional.
I mean, it kind of is a grind for these jurors, with the exception of Fonda, who seems to be the one that takes it seriously.
But you are right.
I mean, it's not a grind that they have to do all the time, but it is still a 6-day grind for them. Yeah.
Yes, and some people have Yankees tickets.
Exactly.
And it's the hottest day of the year. Just like Do the Right Thing.
I know. Well, I mean, and also the guy that talks about having an inside man, there's a guy that talks about one of the hostages saying he has Mets tickets and Pedro's pitching tonight, which is 100% a 12 Angry Men reference as well. Spike Lee loves
Spike's
Sidney
fan.
Lumet. He loves Sidney Lumet.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's on the record. I mean, Inside Man, I'm sure when we did the podcast on it, we talked about how Inside Man is basically just a combination of different Sidney Lumet movies, you know. So
what do you make of the rain coming and breaking the heat halfway through?
Well, I mean, it comes when we sort of reach a 6-6 tie. And so it's sort of a cooling down of the group as a whole. Like, you just sort of have to have this moment where people start to consider like, oh, maybe things are different, you know? We're now on equal footing. We are no longer just sitting here sweating and waiting to be let out. You know, it's sort of a more contemplative sort of situation than you would think when it's 11-1, right? Like when it's 11-1, you still feel like the odds are stacked against Fonda. So you just sort of would be less likely to sit and think about what your decision actually is, you know? Whereas once things become closer to, or once they become exactly a tie, you would maybe, I think, just naturally start to reconsider now that it could go either way. You would really put some thought into it because you don't really have anything to gain by fighting for either side.
Yeah, at this point, no matter the verdict is so literally 50-50 that if you weren't inclined to actually consider this guy's life before this, now you should.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And that the rain cancels the baseball game, and even more American than baseball is justice.
Yes. And even more American than justice is Jack Warden.
That's right.
Yeah. I love that guy.
He's pretty great.
Yeah.
So you, I think you're on record being
as a
pretty
Jack
open.
Warden fan.
As a
Yeah,
Jack Warden fan, now you are. Yeah.
one of the best lines in cinema history in Dirty Work. Anyway, continue. It
as
involves
one of.
birth control, people.
You just said continue.
Yeah, and then I said everybody shut up implicitly. Continue.
You've been noted as not a fan of the single tear. How about the single sweat drop? When Mr.
Yes, you're explaining to other people, not me. when Miss the guy that looks like Slugworth from Willy Wonka is starts to sweat. I'm not crazy about it. I also am not crazy about the line where he says I don't sweat. So just in general, it's a twofer of not ideal, but this movie has earned so many points that a single tear can be allowed from time to time, or a single sweat tear can be allowed.
Okay.
Yeah. At least it doesn't end on a freeze frame.
No, it does not.
Yeah.
How about Mr. Fonda being the man in white force of good with seemingly nothing else to his character, but an undying desire for justice?
Yeah, it's the white is a little much. And it's so funny how, with both War Machine and 3 Days of the Condor, we talked about the stars of those movies influencing how they are portrayed in them or how their character is built in them. And like, Fonda's character in this movie is Juror 8, right? That's his number. He is like almost a parody of Henry Fonda, you know, like he's just the guy standing up for what's good. He is he's wearing a white suit. He's the only one in the room willing to fight for justice despite this unbelievable heat. He's basically like his character from The Grapes of Wrath, his speech from the end of The Grapes of Wrath, like just into a person in a white suit and then put him on a jury, you know, like that's what he is. And it's like almost, it's borderline funny, but he's also legitimately good. Like the reason he was a Hollywood legend is obvious when you're watching this movie. I don't know, he's just he's a legitimately likable presence. So you kind of don't get annoyed with the fact that he's a goody two shoes, you know. He's got that like Ron McClane, like he just reminds you of your dad, no matter who your dad is, you know, as long as you didn't hate your dad, that's who he reminds you of.
Yeah. And he's not even like overly handsome that you can't deal with it.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting to find out that he doesn't like seeing himself act. Now, maybe that's something other people say, but just on the meta level that he didn't like seeing himself act and he never produced another movie. Like, he did this. He did this bit of justice for the world, and then that was it. You know, the way that he essentially saves this boy's life and makes this great movie, even though it wasn't perceived necessarily to that degree at that time, and then walks away. I know he continued being in movies, but I think that's a great little point.
Yeah, exactly. And he was so like, this was just what his image was, and that's why when he ended up being in Once Upon a Time in America as the villain, it was like such a it was a real turn for him, you know, because nobody was used to seeing him play the villain.
Yeah. Such a bleeding heart.
Well, and Sidney Lumet was kind of a bleeding heart liberal as well. Like reading his book, like the first page, the intro, the end of the intro, and this is a book that came out in the early 90s, he's talking about how he excuses himself for using all male pronouns throughout the movie, because he says something like along the lines of, most of my crews have all been male, and this is a regrettable thing about the industry that I'm in, but this is the truth. Hopefully in the future it won't be the same. Like, that's the end of the intro to his book. It's amazing. And he's always sort of shown a real a real liberal mindset throughout his career. I think Dog Day Afternoon is a really great example. But yeah, he was a very, his heart bled for many, you know.
So how does this movie go about kind of asserting its political tone?
Well, I mean, okay, so again, I will cite this book one more time for the last time. He
and apologize for your use of pronouns.
Yeah, so sorry. So sorry. In this movie called 12 Angry Men, I apologize that I'm saying he so frequently. He writes in this book, like, there's a part where he breaks down a variety of his movies and just the idea that drives him, because, you know, when you're a director that commits to a movie, you're committing to a lot of time, and there has to be like a core idea that you're like, I believe in this. And, you know, most of them are a sentence or two, and then you get to 12 Angry Men and it's just the word listen. And like, that was the thing that he was thinking about constantly when making this movie. And I think that's shown pretty well. Like, the thing I like so much about the intro is that there are all these different people whose life stories exist and are worth listening to, right? And just like them, that person who is the accused, despite how damning the evidence might seem on first glance, it is worth actually listening to what is being said and thinking about what's being said to get a more accurate picture of how the situation actually is, how this life actually is. And we get a lot of people in the jury room explaining different facets of their life, so that sort of gets, you know, shows them not being listened to, you know. And you feel that especially with the elderly juror who is at one point explaining how the older man that testifies in the trial, how it's like it's his day to be heard, he's gone so long without being heard, and you kind of feel like he is speaking for himself, mm-hmm. not unlike other characters. Like the guy that grew up in the slum feels like he's speaking for himself at some point while talking about other people. And that sort of idea that these are just a variety of different types of people, all of whom are worth listening to and worth considering as equals, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's everyone, well, most people, I'll say, kind of turn because of something they've experienced, you know, when they've switched their vote to not guilty. It's something that's happened to them, and it takes everybody else in the room listening to their experience or their expertise to help change everybody else's mind, you know, as we see people kind of turn one by one.
Yeah, for sure.
And along with kind of providing information, you know, about how to hold a knife or you know, not sleeping with your glasses on, or that they leave marks in your nose, people also slowly turn away from certain prejudices they have. You know, we have a fairly racist one. We have someone who's kind of just apathetic, you know, someone who just turns with everybody else, you know, as we've sort of reached a consensus, we have somebody turn just for that, and that's not really smiled upon, but that seems to be it. With our big final one, we have a family issue with his son that seems to be what's changing. We have some people who are too focused just on reason. And I think, interestingly, we have a classist thing sort of going both ways. The guy you said grew up in the slums, you know, has learned something from his upbringing that helps shed light onto the situation. And we also have someone else who says, you know, I'm just a working man. My boss does the supposing, as though he's not really used to forming his opinions on his own. And he's gone through this trial and he's had experts say, this is what happened, this is the way things work. And it takes someone like juror number 8 and eventually everybody else to, you know, kind of do what you said, listen to people's personal experiences and how that can shift your perception on reality.
Yeah, exactly. And that's part of the idea behind jury selection, is that you want different types of people that sort of as a whole represent the common population, you know. Although the fact that this is the 1950s and women weren't on juries, you know.
Yeah,
but I'm speaking about jury selection now, I suppose. But yeah, and that is the exact idea, is that you just want different people because different life experiences lead to different pieces of information being things that stick with you. Most of which you have pointed out there. But yeah, no, it is all of these people are just so different, and it is their differences that make the movie interesting.
Yeah, and I love that we kind of get this dichotomy between logic and emotion. And at the beginning, they're saying, just look at the facts. We, you know, when all 11 people are trying to convince juror number 8, saying, look at the facts. These are the facts. You're letting emotion get in the way because they assume he's weak-willed and that he doesn't want to feel guilty about killing this the accused, right? They're saying, these are the facts. Don't let these emotions get the better of you. These are the facts. And I like the way that this movie kind of gets logic and emotion to kind of fold into themselves. You know, as they're saying that you have to focus on the logic of all these things and that emotions have nothing to do with it. But Henry Fonda's character has taken Sidney Lumet's advice and listened. And these things that are facts aren't necessarily facts. You know, the lady thought that she saw this, but, you know, and that sounds like a fact, but the emotion comes in when she didn't sleep with her glasses on because she wanted to appear younger in public, so she didn't wear them. The old man, as he's named, you know, he said that he heard this and he saw this, and that sounds like a fact. But as we see, he's not necessarily lying, but he just kind of wants to fit in, and maybe his memory is kind of shaped to this thing now because he wants to be heard this time. And these logical facts, you know, to be taken just as logical facts and under an attempt to completely remove emotion from it or remove the human element from it, it becomes illogical to think of those things in that way. You know, it's not pure logic when humans are involved, because there are all of these things that can change. And I just really appreciate how that kind of doubles back on itself, and that all of these huge things that seem so insurmountable, all these pieces of evidence, kind of fade away once we realize that there aren't hard facts in the world when there's people involved.
Yeah, for sure. And I don't think we've mentioned this, but you know, it's not like Fonda, juror 8, is coming from an emotional place when he's sort of like, I feel like this guy didn't do it. He's saying, what he's saying at the beginning is that he's just not sure that he did, you know, and the idea is that, you know, the beyond a reasonable doubt sort of thing, like Fonda doesn't feel 100% confident that this guy murdered his father. And that is that's the question that all of these people are supposed to ask themselves. Am I 100% sure? And all that Fonda is arguing is at the beginning is that he's not sure, you know? He's not sure this kid is innocent, but he's also not sure that he's guilty either. And all he wants to do is take that phrase very, very seriously, to the point where somebody needs to prove to him without a shadow of a doubt that the kid is guilty, you know?
Yeah, and I think the way that the first vote is called very publicly, you see some hands go up pretty quickly, but you also get the sense that the last few don't want to rock the boat. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just whatever. Okay, if 9 other people thought this guy's guilty, he's probably guilty. And
which is surely something that happens in juries all the time.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And I can imagine it probably haunts some people.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it just takes one person to say, just because the kind of the snowball is building, that it's unstoppable at this size. And that if we stop and think about this, we can sway the momentum. Not the initial movement of anything doesn't have to be the way that it always goes. And watching those hands go up slowly and him just not feeling the pressure to do what everybody else is doing, is what ends up changing it for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. One thing that I really enjoyed about this movie, or at least a small moment that we haven't discussed, is the way that it addresses the disposability of its own medium, in the movie, which is, I don't know, felt like very non-1950s sort of thing when they're talking about The Amazing Mrs. Bainbridge, and how that, the guy with the octagon glasses can't remember much about the movies he saw 4 days ago. And I just thought that was a really interesting, nice moment, for a movie that ended up being remembered pretty well, to the point where 50 years later, like a sketch comedy show is building an entire episode around a reference to it, you know? And, I just thought that was interesting, because, you know, even somebody like Sidney Lumet, more movies he made than didn't, don't get remembered. You know, it's just sort of a very true fact about most people in the arts career. It's that you're putting so much work into something that will invariably be forgotten.
Yeah. And you mentioned Amy Schumer. There's the Family Guy episode that's built, you know, around the same premise, and I'm sure so many other things that may have disappeared into the ether as
well. Yeah, exactly. The Amy Schumer one is so good. It's amazing.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point that I hadn't considered, though, that to criticize the medium that you're working in, the one that you clearly value and have put a lot of thought in, and then show how little it means to people outside that field within one of its own products is pretty ballsy.
Yeah. I also miss I can't say I missed the period because I was never alive during it, where it was like casually accepted that when you're going to the movies, you're seeing two movies, you know, like yeah. People give me shit about that all the time. I'm just like Coop in Interstellar, I guess. I was born 40 years too late. And also that there's a double feature starting at 11:30 p.m. apparently as well. Just so many things about film going in the 1950s that I'm just very jealous of. Although I'm sure the air conditioning situation was a real problem. But
yeah, maybe the fan doesn't work in there either.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe there's not tables you can just stab knives into in the movie.
Yeah, we have not talked about that moment because that's awesome.
The reveal of the knife?
Yeah. I remember seeing that the first time and getting like really excited about it. It's like such a great moment, and so like it's great partially because it feels so out of character from what we've got gotten from Fonda to this point. It's like he's just been quiet and reserved, and then he's like quietly like, "I'd like to see the knife. Sure, let's see the knife. I'm not gonna do a big reveal or anything." You know, he's like playing coy. And then like even just the way it's framed, I forget who's challenging him, but I know the bad dad juror comes over the shoulder and like in a very sort of forceful way. So now it went from one person in frame to two person in frame, almost like Fawn is about to be attacked. And then we cut to him pulling out a knife. I thought that was really cool. And then the fact that he uses this weapon as just a piece of information, right? Information becomes his weapon, despite the fact that it's information about a literal weapon, you know?
Yeah.
And all of that happens in like 5 seconds. And this movie is a very slowly paced movie that speeds up very briefly, like 2 times. The other part that I can think of is very near the end when Bad Dad and Fonda are having an argument, and there's just quick cuts that feel very un-1950s and feel very frantic, but it helps the movie. But yeah, that knife reveal is so, so good. It's done so well.
Yeah, and 2 things about the knife. First, did you see what Sonia Sotomayor had to say about this movie?
No.
That she thinks it's like it's an inspiration for her. She thinks everyone should watch it. It's one of the reasons why, as an undergrad, she started to focus on law. Mm-hmm. And then she's quick to point out that this is not how you should act in a jury room.
Oh, yeah.
You can't provide your own evidence and do your own research, or else it's a mistrial.
Yeah. Also, just in general, what I feel like one of the things we constantly learn throughout this movie is that the lawyers on this case are terrible, because they're like they're basically doing the trial in the jury room. You know, they're doing what the lawyers are supposed to do, and these all seem to be like big reveals. You know, well, they are all big reveals. It's like, what were they talking about for 6 days? You know,
yeah, and I think that might be, not that this is an idea that only Fonda ever portrays. But it's the power of the little guy, right? Like, you can't rely on the institution. You can't rely on this board judge or the public defender who has other things on his mind and may not really care about this one human at all. But the accused definitely cares about himself a lot. And as a citizen of this country, and we get a little speech from the immigrant juror, it's such a wonderful thing about a country, is that you are given this power, and to abuse it is really morally reprehensible.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, this movie comes out pretty soon after World War II as well, so you sort of get the timing, the juxtaposition of the timing of the movie and that speech too, right? So it sort of adds an extra element there.
Yeah, and the other thing I was going to say about the knife is that it gave us the tense moment of, as you said, Bad Dad, and the idea that he might stab Henry Fonda in front of 10 other people, and I don't know, it feels like kind of a goofy moment on paper, but the tension is ratcheted up pretty nicely there, that you know it's not going to happen, but just the visual of it is so jarring that I think it's still effective.
Yeah, and I think even more effective is the moment when Cobb says to Fonda at a different moment in the movie where he's being held back and he says, I'm going to kill you. And Fonda's like, you don't really mean that, you know, like, just because that's one of the arguments Fonda's making is that people say, I've probably said to you, I'm going to kill you like 400 times, you know, over the amount of time that we've known each other. I've never meant it except for maybe twice. Yeah. And and that's just sort of a cool point and a good callback to it. Just the way that Fonda is able to sort of set up his point and then prove it, you know, and in the span of probably 20 minutes, but enough time for you to kind of forget that point was made, so that you only realize after Fonda says, but you don't really mean it. You're like, oh, that's a callback, you know?
Yeah. And same with the old man doesn't really know what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. This movie's good.
Yep. Sure is. Did you want to talk about the ending, or is there anything more you've got in the meantime?
I don't think so. I mean, I feel like we've gotten it all. But yeah, I do love the last shot of this movie. I mean, the two jurors introducing themselves, like, with their names, the old juror and juror 8, Fonda. That's nice, but, like, the very last shot is the thing that I like the most, which I think there's a cut, right? They couldn't have boomed up that high in the middle of the shot, right? But when Fonda and the old man are shaking hands, and then there's a cut before we get the stairs shot, right?
I don't think that there is, but...
Okay. I honestly don't recall, so I believe you. But anyway...
Steep stairs.
Yeah, okay. Oh, yeah, I guess that makes sense. And so... You know, we see all these jurors, they're now coming out into the world, they're able to walk among the people we were shown at the beginning again. You know, they're back to their own lives, they're going their own separate ways.
Can I back this up just a minute before you get to the very ending?
Yep.
So we have, as you said, we start getting wider shots after the final not guilty is sort of registered, and it ends up being... As I said, this one's more of a father issue. This is a father-son issue. This is the final juror clearly holding something against his son and projecting that onto this 18-year-old who they are here to decide the fate of. And, you know, he says, you work so hard, you work so hard. And one little thing, and I've noticed that other characters do wear watches, as was extremely common in 1957. Mm-hmm. But it looks like he has this gold watch, and it just completely reminds me, especially as he's saying you work so hard, of a retirement watch. Mm-hmm. And something, again, very common, at least from what I've learned through television movies.
Yeah, exactly.
And I've never seen in real life, but I'm going with it.
Yeah. Don't worry, I've never experienced anything in real life, so everything I judge is simulacrum.
Yeah, but when you know, as the economy used to be a lot different, and you would conceivably spend most, if not all, of your adult working life working for one company, you get the gold watch, you get all the that's kind of the big finale at your retirement. And he's saying, you know, you work so hard, and the watch is really present in that. And it's just this idea of that, you know, he's worked so hard for his son, and we don't know, maybe the son really is a bad kid. We don't hear a ton of the story, but clearly they have their differences. And it's, you know, it's just after he kind of yells at them for being bleeding hearts, and I find it brings it into the political realm pretty on the nose. They're not painfully so and ham-fisted, but just this division, you know, this just generational division, and just typically older people are more conservative and younger people are more liberal. And we see that it's this generational divide that seems to affect his opinion on the, on this particular case so much. And you know, I think it's important in this generational divide that this is a case about a man killing his father as well. It's mm-hmm. not just a random mugging or something. It's about this perceived complete rejection of what came before you, you know, and that's, it just seems like the death of conservatism, you know, to be so liberal like these people seems like to be, you know, to be the know-it-all, to be so much more aware of the world than the generation that came before you. And as you said, it's only 12 years before after World War II, and we're just a few ways from a very turbulent 60s and 70s. And just to see this guy who obviously isn't depicted in a very good light, but you do feel sympathetic for him. Or at least I felt a little bit sympathetic for him there. And just this depiction of the passing of time. And, you know, maybe he's a bad person, maybe the kid's wrong, but just this big transitional moment of people feeling extremely out of touch with each other. And I feel this movie obviously sides with the liberal side. You know, it's not shockingly, it's a Henry Fonda starring movie. But just that idea of that division, you know, we've seen different divisions between class within this movie and between race in this movie. But that seems like the big final division is that huge transition. And I just find it interesting that it is on the brink of a very big cultural shift in America.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I really like, I agree with what you said, but one thing I really like about that character's characterization, and it's a very small moment, but when Ed Begley is doing his sort of racist monologue, where he starts to realize his own prejudice, but it's a long walk to get there, a long yeah. racist walk. But every, you know,
everyone to dramatically stand.
Yeah,
up
exactly, and turn their back exactly. But as everybody's that's doing that, the bad dad juror is turning his back on him as well, you know. And yeah. I think that I really like that moment because, you know, he's not just this the old world was better sort of caricature, you know. He's mostly that, but there is also a part of him that understands that at least that sort of intolerance is just not acceptable, you know. And even in the 1950s, you know, he's pretty ahead of the curve in, yeah. to be turning his back towards a racist guy that is on his side of the argument that he is fighting, you know, fighting in the jury room, not the intolerance argument. But the I just thought that was a really nice moment of characterization that it's not attention.
He's not a total monster.
Exactly. Attention isn't drawn to it, but it is just a thing that I think adds a really well-rounded element to Cobb's character in this movie.
Yeah. And then we get this shot from inside the closet as people seem to be individuals again. You know, their mm-hmm. individuality has been restored. They're grabbing their coats one by one and exiting. You know, we've got this wide frame and they leave one by one, and they were individuals, then they were this group of people. As contentious as it was, they were these 12 people with one task, and Bad Dad is there, he's still upset, and Henry Fonda is willing to grab his coat for him, and he doesn't begrudge him. You know, he's seen the error of his ways, and they clearly have differences, but for him to have recognized where he went wrong, it is enough. You know, he's not gonna hold it against him. And then that's when they, you know, he puts his coat back on, and that's where they move outside. So if you want to pick up from where you were describing there.
Yeah, that is a nice moment. I do enjoy that as well. But yeah, as they're walking down the steps in the last shot of the film, they're all going their own separate ways, going back to their lives. Presumably none of these people ever see each other again. And the last thing we see is going down the steps, the last one of them we see going down the steps is juror number 5, Cobb's character, and he's going down the steps in a different part of the steps than everybody else. Not only is he going a bit slower because he's just been emotionally destroyed, yeah. Everybody else is using this sort of like railingless portion of the steps. It's just a very just wide stairs, and he is walking down the center of two railings, and they're pretty close together, and he is somebody that, despite being let out of this jury room, he's still walking walking this path that is like, you know, it's a free path, but it's still got a sort of cage around it. You know, he still feels sort of trapped by what he's realized about himself. And I think that's an amazing, amazing moment to end this movie on, you know, because the actual accused goes free and that juror also gets to live his life, gets to continue on living his life. But there is still, there's still a cage around him of some sorts. And I think it's also a wonderfully subtle moment. And just fantastic in every way, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, it's great. When you start to hate your kids, you're always trapped no matter where you are.
And you'll carry around pictures of them just to rip them up.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, I do think that's good though. It's really not leaned on very hard. We see Henry Fonda go away and it seems like, you know, he's done his good for the world, and we still get this idea that I think it's a positive movie. I think, as I said, it doesn't put institutions in good light, but it frames institutions in a way that if citizens do their part, it's extremely important that they do, I guess.
And I think, I mean, the citizens are a part of the institution. I don't think it necessarily paints the institution in a negative light. I think the implication is that these lawyers suck, but, I don't know. I feel like the jurors are sort of a part of the institution, you know? And yeah. they're the more removed part of the institution, but they are still a part of the institution that we see from this vaunted angle in the opening shot of the movie.
Yeah, and you know, to put your read on him into it, it does say something very big about these institutions and that there's a human element to it, and to see him kind of shaken by this experience and we never see the accused again, I think puts a nice point on this idea of human elements in the being important and being shaped by the larger institutions.
Yeah, for sure.
Sweet.
So thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man.
Throw that down on the stoop and see if the cat licks it up.
James and I will now exit the building down the same staircase, but going in vastly different directions. Thanks for listening.